We are very pleased to present Avital Ronel's Survival Kit for the Anguish. Avital Ronel is professor at the New York University, and since January 2020, she's invited by the Rencontre Philosophique de Monaco as guest philosopher in residence. A prolific author, internationally known in the fields of philosophy, German literature, comparative literature, we are very pleased, and we hope you enjoy Avital Ronel's Survival Kit for the Anguished.
Hi, everyone. It's Avital. Today, I'm thinking about mortality and community, a juncture on which we are dwelling. So what have we learned, if learning is at issue and at stake, and what it means to learn something, what kind of transferential structures are implicated in learning a lesson, what kind of threat is commanded when someone says, I'll teach you a lesson. So in the case of the pandemic, there's something about suffering that has become a public action, and we are asked to surrender a sign of a certain kind of adherence in solitude to the collectivity, because every act and semiotic decision that we make to wear a mask, to be careful, to respect physical distances. This is a decision based on a peculiar juncture of mortality and community that confront each other at every step of the way. So we'll continue to think about this. This is something that the Greeks took very seriously in their tragedies. When do you appeal to a higher order of law giving? Or when do you succumb to the laws of the polis, the nation, or whoever is wielding policing powers over you? So hello, bonjour. I am here on the day after confinement has been lifted, and I want to talk about what the French and the hosts in Monaco call deconfinement, and how we've been face to face with the fatal incoherency of our social organization. Again, you don't need me to urge points of consideration and contemplation for the social disasters that have visited us, or that have not visited us for the first time, but have had a specific way of being disclosed in their nihilistic grandeur and abyssal urgency. So something about the pandemic and the run of this virus, which is running loose and fast and going after apparently arbitrary, but not so arbitrary targets, the poor, the destitute, the truly needy are much more exposed than others, but not everyone is protected, as you know. Again, you don't need me to make these more sociological points stick. You have other discursive formations on which you count, but I guess I just wanted to lay out the premises of my own sense of indignation and anguish, Zalga, and how we want to think about what is happening, what continues to happen, what has always happened, what has not ceased to happen, and what we have trouble coming to grips with. So 2 days ago began what my hosts in Monaco and France call the deconfinement, marking a moment nearly arbitrarily appointed when we were let out of our domestic cages, whether gilded or spare, propertied or state-owned. if I had the technologies and correlate crews, I would review with you now all manner of deconfinements, of lifting of quarantine limits, and of all the true deconfinements of consequence, or even those which managed only to hit a blip on our historical radars. Not all moments of freeing up are registered or chronicled, nor does history show kindness to those who lack the means of chronicling their pain. So I may not have the requisite techies, but I do have fractal interiorities and imaginary sequencing of frames and memory traces, mine or collectively accumulated, of scenes of deconfinement or liberation, which I'd like us to play as a backdrop to today's conversation, to deploy this as a, perhaps as a plea and petition, a motivator capable of crashing through implacable barriers that airlift people blocked or locked, injured and insulted by restrictive conditions of carceral mercilessness. Now, I've taught courses on what Foucault, the historical philosopher, has called the carceral subject, and threading it all the way through Angela Davis's commitment to thinking about prison structures. So I have devoted myself to philosophical considerations of penitentiary culture and how greatly it is disavowed, especially in a country such as the United States that has shamefully and shamelessly the greatest number of penitentiary victims and inmates. So one of my questions has always been, how does this underground culture, or locked up or locked away and sealed off culture, leak or traumatically, I shouldn't say or, and traumatically structure in unacknowledged ways our civic identities and daily practices? It can't be that the only totem and sign of this overwhelming flood of penitentiary grammars and behaviors and lockdowns yields only one sign or signal of its semiotic abundance, such as those beltless pants that people wear as a sign of solidarity with those inmates who are subjected to a prison dress code, or rather a strip code. So one wants to understand how we've suppressed this knowledge of a crowded penitentiary system that must at least produce some kind of rhetorical unconscious and political puncturing that we want to be aware of, how penitentiary and imprisonments and lockdowns of various sorts, in fact, signal, if quietly and sometimes invisibly, and leak into more mainstream types of political decisions and actions and inactions. Our own little allegory, sidelined allegory of confinement, might have inspired more reflection on that part of, and no doubt it did, because you've heard all sorts of testimonial lurches in that direction, or very clear memories of something that had never been marked before, namely, what is it like for those who must yield to solitary and state-imposed imprisonment. So as we expand the particulars of deconfinement, we not only attune ourselves to modalities of confinement that exceed recent episodes of house arrest, and that include the experience of domestic civil war. Now, here I could maybe indulge a sidebar and let you know that something that we all know on some level of consciousness, even if we haven't read Kafka, we know that he had a sense of family that spooks and haunts and hounds us, again, maybe in only unconscious ways. We do know and boast a recognition of Kafkaesque occurrences and scenes of suffocating desperation. But for Kafka, he located the household as a site of penitentiary existence, with his famous father's authoritarian recklessness. What's famous is Kafka's vexed relation to his father, who was very authoritarian, exploited his workers, was kind of militaristically flexed, and also imagine anti-Semitic. The father was very assimilated and showed only disdain for Kafka's commitment to the Yiddish theater and learning about his Jewish heritage. So you didn't have to go far out of the realm of domestic confinement to find all of the formerly maybe located aggressions and micro attacks or major threats that you found outside of the home in terms of internally marked racisms, exploitations, oppressions, and the production of fear that was relentless in the Kafka household. And I don't want to indicate a cartoonish sense of violence and intrusive traumatic restrictiveness, because Kafka also loved his family and was very open-hearted and tender toward his oppressors, and he wouldn't have been as oppressed if he hadn't been exposed by true tenderness and affection to the members of his families. I say families, but I should just say family. Many of whom were deported and murdered in concentration camps. So let me return to the marking of something like a lifting of quarantine or lockdown, and urge us not only to be alert to the dents that family life may have struck and stuck to our personalities, such as they are. During this time, when you were, a lot of you, confined with your bio or chosen or fabricated families, including internal tribunals for those of you who stuck it out alone, let me say that we were not only perhaps attuned and alerted to our own capacities of developing and living with different types of solitude. So it's not just a matter of ticking off solitude versus isolation or even desolation, which was part of the beginning of our podcast typologies. I try to mark differences in the kind of desolate sense of being isolated. But even solitude, as something that at least French philosophers and certainly composers and Goethe's poetry have celebrated, what it means to indulge Einsamkeit or aloneness is always a supply center for poetic insight and understanding, and the premises of joy, even to be able to hold to one's essential solitude, let's say with Blanchot and Goethe and all the other poets and Benjamin. So let's think of the different types of solitude that have emerged or have announced themselves or were snuffed out by you. But there's all sorts of moments or modalities of solitude that we want to be aware of for all sorts of reasons. And certainly with the understanding that for the great philosopher Spinoza, we're not ever really solitary. In other words, we're always worked on, traversed by others, marked by the encounter with others. We know only shared affect. So even if, as we said last time, you're feeling alone, and in the readings that I did elsewhere of Kafka and Proust, motored by Hélène Cixous's insight, I asked what it meant to be all alone. Why isn't it enough just to be alone? Why does Kafka and why does Proust and others say ganz allein, tout seul, I'm all alone? What is that allness of aloneness? Is alone not alone enough? And doesn't that doubling of the magnitude and weight of aloneness also release something? So what does it mean to be all alone would be the question that these writers prompt us to think about. Now, I was honoring our teacher Spinoza, the great philosopher, who says that you're never really in a desert or vacant, but always in a kind of at least minimally concorde or concordance or harmony of hearts, a meeting, a union of hearts that lacerate, that speak, that break, that beat, that name, that feel, even in and especially in withdrawal and absence and destitution. So we're always marked by the other in permanent ways, and in incessantly we're part of a community, even in our greatest aloneness, so that the great poet Rilke can ask, who would hear me if I were to name my distress and stress? But even that call out to a kind of nobody or no one picking up your call or listening in or holding you while you cry or worry in your own most solitary spin, means that you're already calling out from a place of a certain kind of collectivity. But already the fact, and this is not Spinoza, but it will gain on it thanks to the access code granted to us by Spinoza, which is that language as law, as that which limits and structures our being, and language according to Heidegger is the house of being, and we want to consider language as part of a house arrest, and also the double nature of language limiting and socializing and cutting us down, because language often shows up as what Lacan calls le nom du père, so the no, the name of the father. I'll leave that with Kafka in his custody for a moment and shelf it. But the point being that language arrives at us as no, you can't do that, or no, here are your limits. And that's the limits of linguistic confinement as well in the house of being. At the same time, to the extent that we are inundated by language and called to order and come to in and as language, we're already speaking to, conversing with, throwing a cable over to the other, an other, an internal alterity, so that other can be throned or thrown down or seated within, understanding that those locations are kind of scrambled by technologies and other structuring instances of the way you talk to yourself, repair yourself, or talk down to yourself, which one wants to limit to the extent possible. So for Spinoza, even in the greatest experience of destitution, of deserted and vacant being, you are always traversed by the other and always in contact through the heart space and by other modalities of concern and pleasure in the other that we discussed last week, apropos of Hannah Arendt. And we could also discuss in terms of some superb Buddhist monks who urge joy in encounter. In any case, encounter in and through language already binds us to the other, no matter how alone you feel you are. It was thanks to the poet Ceylon, whom I've mentioned a few times, who traverses me day and night, that the counter in encounter became something to think about. So what is the little hit that the encounter, even the persecution of the encounter, as Levinas will say elsewhere and differently, how do you measure or take or hold or carry the contre, the gegen in the begegnung, or the counter in encounter? So I'm also jamming on the counter here because that's part of the name of the rencontre philosophique, my hosts, my dwelling place, my disrupted residence. What does it mean to have a residence, to be dispossessed of a residence? And certainly I've been honored with a glorious residence that was cut short in some ways by the urgency of the pandemic run that is still holding forth and holding us back in some ways. So for Spinoza, we are only more or less free, even when we think we're free and in our greatest freedom. And that's in part, if I may reduce it to a thumbnail description or a recall, that's because we don't know the causes of our freedom. Even if you feel free, can you name and elaborate and understand the causes of your freedom? So this will be for another discussion, what it means to be freed up, liberated, even in terms of the many tracts and thoughts on emancipation, here I would refer you to Jean-François Lyotard's work on the, let's say, disappointed limitations of a true emancipation. But that's, again, I'm going to shelf that so that I can move through the day of deconfinement, the week of deconfinement, the weaknesses of deconfinement, and the question of whether one can be fully deconfined, whether or not we had been marked, and often fatally marked, by this viral aggression. The viral aggression, by the way, is also a call for another justice, despite its calamitous disasters and aggressions. It also put out some demands and petitions on behalf of the earth, of animals, of racial justice. So it's a more complicated mapping and relational imperative that's being brought to our attention than merely seems to be designated by imagining a war. That's not to undermine the struggles and the devastation and the criminal negligence that has attended this viral outbreak. So there are different types of solitude. Let's have that as part of our lesson today. There's the cringing solitude, the aloneness of regressed states when you're terrified and you're child parts seem to predominate and scare the shit out of you. There's abandonment. There's the experience of night sweats and of desocialization. Or there's even the surplus socialization, which leads to a certain kind of pull into solitude. So surplus socialization might have occurred to you with too many intrusive phone calls, Zoom gatherings, Skype meetings, the familial stranglehold that Kafka articulated so well, and that may have informed parts of your experience of lockdown. And the flooding demand of internal redistricting. Like, how will you handle yourself through this strange temporal warp that it goes, has time running too quickly, or you're already running out the clock, suddenly it's quick, then it's slow-mo. So it wasn't easy to regulate or time our relation to time. This in itself is a heavy existential legacy of lockdown that we want to continue to probe and read together. So there was also, in terms of a different type or a typology of solitude, there's also, and I invite you to list other types of solitude or journal about it that you think you can designate or that you weren't able to achieve. A lot of people wanted to meditate. A lot of people wanted to write. It was a lot of busyness as almost a commando reactivity, I'd say, to the the emptiness that was suddenly imposed. But there was also, I think, on a more upswinging kind of register, there was also the triumphal sovereignty of a solitude hard won, bravely endured, that tells you have rocked this confinement. phase one is behind you. Now, of course, I say that with certain excessive cheerleading glee, but I do want us to open up and spill on the kinds of solitudes that you may have discovered, the kinds of dimensions and interiorities that you were able to construct. And as we discussed previously, maybe you were able to promote and produce and shape a good object. Maybe you were called to your own most creativity, or you remembered a part of yourself that had been minoritized and sidelined. So there's the sovereignty of a solitude bravely endured and hard won and well handled that tells you you've made it through a very tough pass, that a phase of endurance and testing, self-testing and difficulty is behind you. So time has clicked in and started surpassing and passing and allowing you to move through something that seemed unmovable. And yet you find at the same time that remembrance is swiftly fading. I mean, do you remember these yesterdays that were kind of blandly unfolding or manically appropriated and made to have you be an artist, a writer, very creatively swinging into the new technologies, not so new, but very, very many of you were called to inscribe something artistically, and we should think about why that was and how that was and how necessary that is and will be. So do you remember? What is the relation to remembrance? Because confinement bears the traces of a traumatic snuff out, the destitution of event. So was this an event in the sense that we think we understand it, an event, or perhaps more profoundly, was it an event in the sense that you never capture an event? It bypasses you, you can't perceive it. So it bypasses one's ability to understand and know what has happened. And I will address the depletion of our collective memory banks another time and ask what it means that you forget all the more for trying to remember. If I asked you to write down what you remember and how you remember this period of fear, illness, and lockdown, I would want to hear how much goes into oblivion, into the folder of oblivion. So as we proceed, let us count up scenes of liberation, flickers of jubilation, emancipatory surges, no matter how diluted they appear to be after a period of celebratory grace. Is this something to celebrate, or is it the beginning of a national mourning, an international, pan-national mourning that will never end? So a necessary melancholia, which is a mourning disorder, or will we give over ourselves over to another type of mourning disorder, which is manic? How does mania fit into the inability to mourn what is happening, whom we've lost, and what exactly maps out as inextricable loss? So as I remember scenes of historical deconfinement, I think of the solemn, dignified walk of Nelson Mandela, who was freed at last from prison, the shocked faces of American troops liberating concentration camps, and the looks of decimated inmates. More disjunctively, I think of, and on an entirely different register, the frolicking leaps of pupils when school lets out for the summer, or the countless, again, another register that requires more transition. So excuse my scandalous leaps to absolutely non-reciprocal moments of freeing up. I think also of the countless people of color dismissed from a wrongful prison term, greeted by a small group who believed in them all along, a sister, a weeping mother, self-sacrificing Antigones who go up against the state. Virginia Woolf said that women have always been in some form of confinement. You can feel the sway of their imagination and secret writing habits on the thick walls of older houses and buildings. Beyond the examples of social injustice, there is a way of seeing stuckness, which we've just and are continuing to experience, as an existential quality, par excellence. It's a facticity. Even the granting of being where you are bereft of autonomy. So there's something that's still granting or giving where you stand stuck or sit stuck or lie stuck, where you are bereft of autonomy, but all the more beholden to responsibility. That's a rift between autonomy and responsibility that Kant addresses that we can discuss elsewhere. And I used to analyze our drug cultures when I wrote a kind of a dictionary. So when I was trying to address different dependencies and if you're truly autonomous, which is highly problematic as a, and I think Spinoza, Rousseau, Defoe, and all the island dwellers who are calling out to their communities, real and imaginary, would not abide it for long. But if you were truly autonomous, you would have certain rights toward yourself to indulge in all sorts of what we call too quickly unhealthy habits and already dependencies, which already annuls the edge of autonomy. But what is the relation between responsibility and autonomy? This is one of the major questions that that we will have had to confront, not only now, but since at least the different typologies of liberations and confinements that have run through centuries of human self-exploration, self-expansion, and disastrous overreach of the human trust in itself and its figurations and tropologies. And what I mean by that is that something like a virus really humbles and humiliates and limits our sense of the ability to steer ourselves with control, with knowledge, with sovereignty, all of these important political and philosophical and existential terms have to be brought to a hearing because they really seem to overwhelm our thoughts and overestimate the capacity of what has passed for human to be a guest, to host, and to show respect for the worlds that still need to be created, retrieved, honored, and also that require the strength to set them free, meaning let them go. So this has been a little too fast for us, but that's okay. I'd like you to take what you can from some of these contemplative clusters and let us continue to think together. In the meanwhile, as we go out of lockdown and maybe return to it and maybe feel the ambivalence and fear of an artificially set clock that wants our freedom from restrictive norms that have now limited our freedoms, let us think of all of the problems that face us with humble incertitude and commitment to that juncture between mortality and community and what it is we owe responsibly to the other. So take care and see you next week. Bye.